Well, we needed to know about surgeons. Surgeons have to practice. Our how-to series, talking to experts outstanding in their fields, brings us to surgeons. How do they gain their expertise after working on cadavers and simulations, after spending years watching and assisting and being mentored? The moment comes when they're the ones. As patients, our well-being is in their hands, literally. So how do surgeons know where to cut, how deep, what to look for, and even more so, what does it feel like moving fingers around the lobe of a brain, pushing a liver aside, holding a beating heart? We explore the hands-on aspect of surgery this hour. Two surgeons in our studios. Richard Ellenbogen is chairman of neurological surgery at the University of Washington School of Medicine. Eric Freunas is chief of general surgery at Capitol Hill Specialty Center for Group Health Permanente. We're going to talk to them about the work they do and how it feels. But we start at the UW Medical Center in an operating room of orthopedic surgeon Dr. Seth Leopold. He's getting ready to replace a patient's hip to cut off part of the bone, retool the socket, and put in, with saw and drill and mallet, a brand new joint. He might do 300 hip and knee replacements in a year, maybe six a week. In an hour, an old and painful infirmity is gone for the patient, but there is work involved. Dr. Leopold says his interests are in less invasive methods of hip and knee replacement surgery, lessening recovering time and decreasing post-operation pain. Katie Sewell and I were in the operating room for this live hip replacement surgery. It took their team of nurses and assistants and interns to give the patient a new hip. This is a shortened version of that procedure, and with the sounds you hear, you'll know it's the real deal.
Surgery that you're here for now is a hip replacement. Patient with osteoarthritis and significant pain and difficulty walking even short distances. It's considered major surgery. As you'll see, it's like a dance. It's a smooth process flowing from one step to the next, but it's got a lot of steps to it, and there's a lot of planning that goes into it, and including making blueprints, which are called templates, to make sure that we get things like leg length and biomechanics of the joint restored accurately.
So you have to cut her bones, right?
Yes.
So
yes.
What does that feel like?
It feels quite a bit like when you use a power saw in your wood shop. The consistency of the bone when a saw passes through it is not a lot different than if you were passing a saw through pine board. You can see on her x-ray, on her better side, you've got the ball and the socket. This is her pelvis. So she's looking at us. Here's her left hip and here's her right. Between the ball and the socket, you can see a smooth black line. But on the side that we're operating on, her right hip, you can see there's no space. There's no black line there. So her cartilage is completely worn away and she's bone against bone. So that bearing surface is gone. It's shot. So each time she takes a step, it's a grinding and a popping and a pain. And it's keeping her from walking even short distances. And so what we're going to go in there and do is to take off this arthritic portion of the ball, reshape the socket till it's round, and put in some man-made components. So those are the goals of the operation, to get the leg length right, to get the tension in the muscles right, and to get the joint real stable so it doesn't dislocate when she does her daily activities afterwards. Putting in the new bearing should take the pain out of it when she walks on it. I'm going to get washed out.
You have two sets of gloves on. Okay, what does that do to your sensitivity?
You lose a bit of sensitivity, but the work that I'm doing, you can see, is going to look a little bit more like cabinetry than like fine motor stuff. And so it's certainly worth the trade, and the difference in sensibility in my fingers is negligible.
Right hip is marked, right hip replacement.
Thank you very much.
We're marking out the location where the incision is going to go at this point, just feeling for bony landmarks through the skin. So a lot of this is by feel. You know, in order to place the incision where we want it to go, we've got to be able to feel the landmarks easier in slender people and harder in larger or more muscular people. Her anatomy through the skin is fairly straightforward. She's a slender lady, not too muscular. That pressure looks good. Can we get underway?
Yes.
Jolene, I'm taking a knife.
Thanks.
13-16 on incision.
There you go.
So through the skin, this yellow tissue that you see here is fat.
Take a cough, please.
And the consistency of it is slippery, not unlike butter. This next tissue, this white tissue here that you can see, is called fascia. And it's fairly firm and resistant. It's got almost the fence when you cut through it, like it's almost canvas-like. Not quite as tough as canvas, but not a lot different either. Knife, please.
First plate.
Thank you. This is an electrical cautery device. It stops bleeding. It can also be used to cut tissue. Sometimes when I dissect through muscle, we use that a little bit to keep the bleeding to a minimum. Underneath the fascia, the next thing you'll see is muscle. That's this red tissue here.
Thanks, that's good.
And that has the consistency of a very, very fresh steak. In other words, you can probably push your finger into it or indent it, but it has some resistance to it. So here's the front edge of the medius, here's the back edge, here's about the tip of the trochanter, okay? So just coming through muscle down to get down to the level of the hip here. You have to be sensitive to it. You have to have a feel for it to know how quickly to dissect through it so you don't go through the deeper layers if you're not intending to. So coming down onto the capsule, which is the tissue surrounding the hip joint. So you can see getting down to the hip, you're coming through a number of layers and identifying each of them and protecting the important things that are inside them is what makes the dissection something you have to learn. Can I have a big little? Thanks. Dan, can you get over the hip? Okay. So if you look in there, you can actually see the arthritic ball here, and we're going to pop it out and you'll see it better in a minute. Can I have a hip skid? Take that one out. Two in a row today, huh? Good.
Ready?
Yep. Easy and slow, Dan said. Real awesome. Good. So there's a lot of suction holding that ball into that socket, and that's what you heard. So what I'm showing you here is her arthritic ball. Can I have a... You have a retractor here?
Yep.
I'm going to show you something. You'll be able to hear this. If there was cartilage on that, it would be a muffled sound. Where there's cartilage, it makes a different sound. And this is raw bone being tapped by metal. You shouldn't hear that, okay? And somebody with a cartilage pad that should be a quarter inch thick, you wouldn't hear it at all. She doesn't have any even normal cartilage left for me to show you. So this is a guy that's got score marks on it. It's like a ruler. And we measured on our blueprints that we wanted to make the cut just shy of a centimeter, about 8 millimeters above the landmark that we've just identified, which is a part of her thigh bone. And so I'm going to make a mark on the neck of her femur, which is the part right below the ball, and we'll cut along that mark. Saw, please. This is a power saw, like the one you get in Ace Hardware. The consistency of that is probably similar to cutting pine with a high-speed saw. Now we'll take the ruler, double-check our work. So I was pointing out to you that she's got some bone spurs on her x-ray before, and some of them are fractured even. I'm going to take some of those out now, this biting device. That's a bone spur, excess piece of bone overhanging the edge of her socket. That's a retractor being placed into the bone of her pelvis, and I put it right into the bone so it doesn't have to float free, because there's a nerve back there, and I don't want that retractor floating around and irritating that nerve. We're taking that ring of bone spurs down, try to get a sense of what direction the new socket that I'm going to put in wants to face. If you get it in the wrong alignment, her hip replacement, her man-made hip, can become unstable. You really want to make it as accurate as you can get it the first time through. So we're taking her misshapen socket and with these hemisphere-shaped reamers, turning it back into a round shape. Well, I think 54 is going to be just perfect. So this is a titanium socket, it's a hemisphere. It's got some holes that we're going to pass screws through, and it'll take a plastic bearing that we're going to use on her. Thank you. I have a drill. We're using her landmarks to make sure that the socket goes in where it belongs. Do you have the shorter drill? You notice there's no glue holding the component to her bone. The components have microscopic pores that her bone can lock into, and that takes about 6 weeks' time. Good. Oh, work on her her femur now, her thigh bone. So this is the cut surface of the femur where we took the ball off, and down this way is the right down the pipe, right down the tubular part of her thigh bone. We're going to get a stem into her into the tubular part of her thigh bone. Yeah, we've now got the man-made ball and socket trial components, in other words, the practice components in place, and we're just trying to move her leg through a plausible range of motion. And if there's still some play between the ball and the socket as I'm tugging on it, so that I know that things aren't in there too tight. If it was too tight, there wouldn't be any play when I gave the leg a gentle tug. We just want a very small amount. That actually feels pretty good. So this is a stem, also titanium. This area here is where there are microscopic pores that the bone's going to lock into, so we can put this thing in without any cement at all. So it goes down to a place where it locks in and doesn't go any farther. That's how we know we're done. It gives a feedback, just like when you're using a chisel again in a wood shop. The tissue pushes back, or the bone pushes back against the implant as you're tapping it in. The pitch changes, so you're listening as well as feeling, and when it stops, it stops. If you go too far, you risk splitting the femur like you would split a log with a wedge. -3, please. And that's it. We're just about done.
That was Dr. Seth Leopold, University of Washington Medical Center orthopedic surgeon, replacing the hip of a patient. You can find out more about their work and their and what they do at their website, which is linked at our website, kuow.org. Our how-to series continuing with the hands-on aspect of surgery. We've looked at knitting. We've looked at how to make neon. We've looked at tree work. And the tree surgeons did not like being, they didn't like the phrase tree surgery. They were arborists. But here we have surgeons. Richard Ellenbogen is chairman of neurological surgery at the University of Washington School of Medicine, the Theodore S. Roberts Endowed Chair in Neurological Surgery, and the chief of neurological surgery at Harborview Medical Center. And you work at Children's as well.
That is correct.
Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having us.
And Eric Freundes is chief of general surgery at the Capitol Hill Specialty Center Group Health Permanente as well. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Steve.
Well, let me just start by asking both of you. So Dr. Freundes first. You were in surgery last week.
Yeah.
What are some memorable surgeries you did last week?
Steve, I do mostly surgery of the chest and abdomen, and do a variety. I've did two resections for lung cancer, removed two gallbladders, drained a large abscess in the abdomen. Did a video-assisted resection of a colon for cancer and another open resection for colon cancer.
What's a resection, by the way? What does that entail? Especially, what does a lung cancer resection entail?
Generally, it means removing part of the lung for a cancer. The lungs are divided into several different lobes, so you don't have to remove an entire lung usually. You can remove part of it.
And then the resection is that you're then retying it, reworking it, so it's...
Resection just means removing part of it, tying off all the parts that go to it, the blood vessels, the airway.
Mm-hmm. All right, and Dr. Ellenbogen, what your last surgery was?
Well, I kind of have a diverse practice, so I did some surgery at Harborview Medical Center where I did a large brain tumor in a 50-year-old truck driver, and I took care of a trauma patient afterwards, took out a blood clot. And then at Children's Hospital, I take out pediatric brain tumors and do craniofacial surgery, which is to reconstruct children's skulls and so on.
So there's so much to talk about, 20, 30 years of work and experience that have gone into this. So I have 20 minutes. So I'll focus on some of the work you do, just the actual physical work that you're doing. But so Dr. Leopold, And you heard him in the in the piece. He said it's like that. He alluded to it being like carpentry. That cutting the bone was a little bit like cutting a pine, a piece of pine board. Of course, it's not carpentry, but he alluded to it being in that way. How do you describe what you do as a brain surgeon? If we're getting some metaphors here, if it's like carpentry, what's brain surgery like then?
I think the equivalent would be we're like watchmakers. Our surgery is exceptionally fine. It's done under the microscope. It has to be precise. We can't throw out any parts like Seth was doing. Every part of the brain is important and does something. So we have to navigate the brain. And it also is a bit like, I suspect, like flying a jet, because we use surgical navigation to be very precise to get where we need to be, even when we use our endoscopes, to make sure we're precisely where we need to be so they don't lose a function that is essential to them, like their memory or their arms or their legs or their memory of second grade.
How would you, so watchmaking, carpentry, Dr. Fuentes, how would you describe, what's your metaphor? Do you have a metaphor for chest and thoracic surgery that you're doing?
I'm not sure I have a good metaphor. My surgery really falls into two different types. One is where it's an open surgery where you can really just get your hands in there and feel things and work with the tissues. And the other is a video-assisted where you're working with long instruments placed into the belly or the chest and looking at a screen up on the wall and looking at a two-dimensional plane while you're doing the surgery.
Which is harder? But just in terms of, I guess, conceptualizing it, perhaps?
Definitely the video-assisted. Yeah, and the main difficulty of that, or the challenge, is there is a loss of tactile sensation when you're doing that kind of surgery. There's a loss of three dimensions.
We're bringing you a series of how-tos, and this how-to is how do brain surgeons, how do chest and thoracic surgeons, how do surgeons prepare, how do they use their hands to do the work they do? Richard Ellenbogen is chair of neurological surgery at the UW. Eric Freundes is chief of general surgery at Group Health. So that hip replacement took surgery was just that. The actual surgery was an hour, which is a pretty remarkable hour. I wonder what's the length of your surgeries overall, Dr. Freundes? I mean, is an hour the proper length for that lung cancer resection, or do they take a lot longer, less time?
It varies incredibly. For mine, it might be 15 minutes for an operation. It might be 6 or 8 hours.
Well, so what's a 15-minute one? Any of those that you mentioned, were those 15-minute operations?
No. Those varied from maybe 30 minutes to 3 hours.
To 3 hours.
Sort of thing.
So when a three-hour operation, so which was the three-hour one?
Removing part of the lung.
So what's the intricacy that it takes 3 hours? What's going on? First of all, can you tell which is the diseased part of the lung by looking at it?
You can, and by feeling it. The tactile sensation is very important, actually, in the lung. The lung is very soft, softer than a sponge, collapses completely. So a normal lung almost collapses down to nothing. And being able to feel the tumors is very important in the lung.
What do they feel like?
They feel hard, and they feel irregular, generally, very distinct from a normal lung tissue.
What would describe some of the tools you're using for a lung cancer resection? I mean, what does the scalpel look like? And what we saw yesterday in getting the bone out, there were a number of long metal. You know, if I'd been working on my car trying to get some nails out of a board, I would have been using some sort of similar tools. So, what are the tools that you use look like?
Well, orthopedic surgeons are known for getting their tools at Sears and Roebuck, but ours aren't all that different. For general surgery procedures, the tools we've been using are really ones that have been around for 100 years. Very simple things, scalpel, scissors, clamps, forceps to pick things up. So most of it's not all that complex, really. We don't really use a knife much, which surprises a lot of people. People give me a knife and think I'll be good at it, carving the turkey and things. We basically use the knife to open the skin, and then we're using other tools for the whole procedure.
Dr. Ellenbogen, so your surgeries are, you said, how long are some of your regular
surgeries? Considerably longer. A short major surgery would be about 4 hours. The brain tumor I operated on was about 8 hours.
So Dr. Freundes was talking about being able to feel the lung and feel what the tumor feels like. What's it like to go into the brain?
It's a little more. You have to have a tactile sensation that's fairly sophisticated because you're feeling through micro instruments. So you have tiny instruments attached to your fingers, and you have to train your fingers to turn them and move them so that you're only taking out, for example, in a brain tumor, you're taking out the bad tissue and leaving in the brain tissue.
Now, you're holding what could be like a tweezer. Is that the kind of... Is that, this is something much smaller, right?
Yeah, this is a micro scissor that we might cut a blood vessel that's a few, less than a millimeter in diameter after we coagulate it, which is, in other words, closing it with heat.
And are those all those?
Yeah, these are all the micro instruments that
that's
we use.
Larger. I mean, I'm calling them tweezers. Because
yeah.
These are
micro forceps. They're made in, most of them are made in Germany, and they're made to perfection. And they usually cost thousands of dollars each instrument, and they all have their purpose, and they're always evolving. A lot of what we do is computerized. And so when we navigate the brain, we're sitting under a microscope that may be attached to a computer that is telling us precisely where we are in the brain. The brain itself feels like a firm jello, and we try not to touch it with our fingers. Sometimes we can't resist, but we try to only touch it with our instruments, and we try to make a small openings in the brain. A lot of times what our operations are sneaking under the brain or through fissures, in other words, crevices in the brain, so that we disturb none of the functions. So,
are there parts of the brain that you don't want, that you wish you didn't have to go towards in your operations?
Well, the parts of the brain that are especially treacherous are the areas that subserve function that patients want to keep, such as speech, motor function, and then of course there's always the brainstem that is the main cable from the brain to the spinal cord. So interrupting anything in the brainstem can affect your heart rate or your breathing, and we often have to operate around the brainstem quite often, and we do that with very sophisticated monitoring, so we know if we ever touch a certain area, the monitors go off and we stop touching that area.
You know, we had talked on the phone, Dr. Furness, about that you don't get to practice. You don't get to know how a body feels until you're there the first time. I mean, I know there's a lot of simulation. There's a lot of work you can do on cadavers, on parts of the body when they're out, and you get a lot of time to work as assistants. But how do you know that you're a good surgeon? What is it about what you do that tells you, I really feel this in a way that makes me feel confident? I know that's sort of a difficult question because how do you know when you're good at something? But
I think the way that I know, or at least one of the ways that is most gratifying to me, is that I see the family of other doctors who could choose who they can see. They come to me themselves. They send their family to me. So I think that is the most gratifying thing and the thing that makes me feel like I'm doing a really good job. Hmm. And there's lots of other ways to judge, how surgery goes, obviously, whether you're having complications. And
did you know when you wanted to be a surgeon that you had, that, I guess, tactile sense that you could go into you had the patience, you had the methodical nature that you could go into a person's body and move a lung, resection?
No, I'm not sure I did. I'm not sure I did. Life is really a path. I didn't start out to be a surgeon. I ended up that way, and I'm really happy I did. I think it's important that you have some degree of hand-eye coordination to be a good surgeon, but I think it is far from being the most important thing.
What is?
Surgery, I think, is really mostly mental. At the end of a long day of surgery, I'm mentally exhausted. My hands aren't tired. Mm-hmm. The work you do in surgery and how you do it depends a lot more on the planning, the priorities, the decision making, than actually moving your fingers, I think, to a large degree.
Hmm. Dr. Ellenbogen, did you always want to be a neurosurgeon? Was that something you pursued?
No. I couldn't make professional basketball in New York, so I'm teasing. I don't think it's one of those paths that you choose after going through college and realizing that that's what you wanted to do for the rest of your life. And neurosurgery was not on the top of my list, but I did a rotation in neurosurgery when I was in medical school, and I was inspired by the neurosurgeon at the time.
Is that right?
And the brain is a very famous neurosurgeon who has long been dead, and he warned me not to go in the field. He said, you need to do this against all good advice. This is a horrible field. And I said, why do you do it? And he says, because I like being depressed all the time. So that sounded attractive to me, that you could help people and be that thoroughly exhausted at the end of the day and feel like you've done something. But it's the most satisfying profession I can ever imagine.
Well, that went a lot faster than any of the surgeries you were talking about. I appreciate you both coming in today. Dr. Richard Ellenbogen is chair of neurological surgery at the UW Harborview. Dr. Eric Freund is chief of general surgery at Group Health. Thank you both for talking with us. Much appreciated.
Thank you, Steve.